Hello and welcome to Ropescast, the independent voice of the Middle East. I'm Ibrahim Abu Ahmad.
And I'm Ksenia Svetlova. ROPE stands for the Regional Organization for Peace, Economics and Security. We are a young organization that works to lay the groundwork for a post-conflict Middle East by connecting forward-thinking Israeli, Palestinian and Middle Eastern leaders all across the region. We share a holistic vision for the Middle East where everyone has more to win from the conflict, resolution and integration than to lose. If you are looking for more information on ROPES, please visit our website, ropes.org.
Our very special guest for today is one of our ROPES alumni, Manar El-Sharif.
Born and raised in Damascus, Manar El-Sharif organizes youth dialogue forums and civic initiatives to promote a culture of tolerance. A journalist by profession, she lives in the UAE and pursues her passion for connecting creative young people across borders throughout the region through sports, education, and media. And also, Manar has a very unique, I would say unbelievable story in Gaza, being jailed by Hamas.
Hello, Manar, and welcome to the Ropescast.
Hi, hi, Ibrahim. How are you?
Hi, Manar.
Hi, Ksenia. Good, I'm fine. Thank you for having me, and let's begin.
Yes, well, amazing. Manar, so you indeed have a really incredible and interesting background. You were born in Damascus, and then you also lived in Gaza for a while. In 2017, you decided to study journalism and applied to Islamic University in Gaza, which, by the way, now lays in shambles, and it was destructed during the airstrikes. Can you please share with us your experience? I mean, why did you want to go to Gaza in the first place? And, you know, there is this, of course, image that Gaza, you know, is a place that is under siege, that it's very difficult to be inside. And for an outsider, you know, coming from a different country and with experience in many different countries, how did you feel about it? You know, how was your first experience in Gaza? Please tell us to us.
Well, Ksenia, well, due to the civil war in Syria in 2011, we struggled a bit and then we decided to move out of the country to Cairo. So we moved there in 2013 and we stayed in Cairo as a family, discovering how we could begin our life again. And from there, my family got the option for me to study in Gaza, as it's not really a long way to go from Egypt to Gaza. It's, I think, only 600 kilometers. And I decided to go in 2017 in February to Gaza. And I went alone. My family stayed in Cairo. And the option was to study in the Islamic University. And I didn't say no for the experience and just was open to it. And I discovered when I went to register that it's a university where you have to commit to the dress codes and not having any makeup or not having any piercings or being just, you know, in a Muslim dress code. And also, I didn't have an option to say no, so I decided to get in, like any girl would just study in this university. It's, of course, not mixed between men and women. It's only a campus for women and a campus for men. And I joined it, and I started to discover what I'm going to learn in this university. And I was quite surprised that the things I was studying, it's all about how they feel proud about what they did so far as a Hamas movement and what the religion is also saying, you know, for them. So they were trying to say that, you know, journalism not far from following religion and all the stories about religion and also stories about Hamas and their propaganda. So it was more about them, but not more about journalism and being independent to have your opinion maybe or to have the voice of reality. So a few months later I decided to drop the university and just to be with the Gazans and live with them and understand them more, and maybe from there I can be a journalist by myself. So that what happened.
Can you give us a little bit shed light on you know, life in Gaza? You know, how is life there for the simple Gazan citizen? What are things people talk about?
Yeah, well, since I got into the city of Gaza, I discovered that it's so crowded to get into Gaza, and it's so hard. People were can struggle to get in and to get out in Gaza through Rafah crossing. And that was the first experience I got. And then when I got inside, I started to understand the people more, where you can see that it's all about families. It's very rare to see people like me just coming from outside to study or maybe to work or something. So it was quite strange for them. But despite all of that, I was welcome to stay with the families and to ask questions and to speak freely with them. So yeah, as I said, it's all about families. This is what they care about. And this is what they concern about the most, about how they can feed them and how can they assure a good future for them. It's quite hard for them to live, you know, with electricity 6 to 8 hours a day, or not having possibilities to work around, or not having, you know, a plan for the future, or even in terms of health or terms of education. They had quite life hard to, you know, assure that every section in life is just covered. So let me say they, every day they struggle with their daily life, and sitting with them more and listening to their stories more, I discovered that the first part they blame for the situation is Hamas. Since they control Gaza in 2007, everything changed for them, where they started to, you know, like, let me say Hamas, when they took over, they started to, you know, change Gaza as a shape, as something, you know, they could have for fun for the people. Let me say, if there's cinemas, I think they burned all the cinemas. If there's places to have fun, like drink alcohol, or maybe clubs, or maybe restaurants, like open restaurants or things like this, I think they all shut it down. And they started to give the people an idea that we are here to just take our land back, and this is something you have to focus on, but not to get busy with life and to have fun with life, or maybe to have a plan for your life. So the people started to suffer since that moment. And for them, the BA was a good option. And Israel, when they were controlling Gaza, was a good option for them, where they didn't feel that they are affecting their daily life, you know. Also, they struggled, of course, and they suffered in 2007, where Hamas took over and they started, you know, to take it by force, and even also affect the Palestinians from the BA, and started, you know, like to arrest them. Or
I, you know, what I wanted to ask you, you said that you came through Rafah crossing in 2017 through Egypt.
Yeah.
I would like to ask you about the freedom of movement at the time, because, you know, we, you know, very often hear about, you know, that because the border between Israel and Gaza is mostly closed since the coup d'etat that Hamas performed in 2007, then, you know, Gaza is completely sealed off and people cannot communicate to the outer world. Could people from Gaza in 2017 travel to Egypt for studies or for medicine, medical reasons, just to visit their relatives and so on? Or was it hard?
Well, no, it was hard, of course, and it can take days, it can take months, you know, to just coordinate with the Egyptian side and get their names and, you know, just to cross the border. It was quite hard, where the Palestinians, or let me say Hamas in particular, had a, you know, tough time to be able to communicate with the Egyptians, maybe, or maybe they wanted that as an option, you know. I don't know, they didn't succeed anyway to have a good relationship with Egypt for, you know, letting the Palestinians from Gaza just to travel freely through Egypt. Well, what I noticed, Ksenia, that Hamas failed to have a good relationship with Egypt in order to make the Palestinians travel freely through Rafah crossing. And over years, it started to be a business for both sides, where they asked the people, you know, a big number of money just to let them cross the border. And, you know, it can take days, it can take from 2 to 3, 4 days just in order to cross from Gaza to Egypt. And that is something also people noticed about what's happening, and they started to have the negative feelings towards what's happening. But it's hard to complain where they have no way to communicate with people from outside, or maybe other governments, you know, like it's hard for them to express what they are going through. This is what I noticed.
And you talked a lot about, you know, you mentioned Hamas's role in preventing normal life from taking place in Gaza. And just as a one unit to add, you know, a fight for the land, you actually decided to go against that. And, you know, with your work as a peace activist, you try to bring something different in Gaza. And actually, you were arrested for it a couple of times. Can you share with us what happened then on those two occasions?
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, for me, trying to understand more the history of Gaza and trying to understand what's the people's demands and what the people's problems, I discovered that they have no problems or any hate towards Israel or towards their, you know, rules or agreements or whatever, and they were welcoming to that option to come to Gaza or maybe to have something with Israel. And we have it in a very clear image where many people from Gaza, it's I think 1,800 workers go to Israel every period of time to work there and come back to Gaza with having no problems. So they were appreciating this step from Israel, and they were wishing, you know, to continue in a very big circle among the Gazans. So this is something I noticed, and you know, I felt that we must not be silent about that, and let's express it in a way that the people in Gaza feel it's hard to express about it, where the media in Gaza also is controlled by Hamas. So here we started to do some individuals' efforts to express, to let the people anyway express their feelings or what they are thinking about, or if they are appreciating something in a very good way or in a very smart way, let me say. Here we started, I joined, through my journey in Gaza, I joined a group in Gaza, it's called the Youth Committee. And I became a member of them where they were having the same idea as I was imagining, that these voices should just get out of Gaza and we need to do something, at least if we are not able to do something through governments, maybe let's start with the people. Maybe they both can affect on their governments. And from this stage, we had, you know, the first, I think, initiative we did, it was through, or let me say, when they were having the March of Return demonstrations on the borders, we started to think, what if we went to the border, but we can send another message, which is, you know, to launch pigeons through the border from Gaza to the world. And we were trying to say by this message to the Gazans, well, we were like 30 persons from Gaza. And we were trying to say, well, if you are mad, if you are angry, if you are having any message, you can send it in just a different way, not to send it by fire balloons or something to the border. So it was like trying to give the people some awareness. So we did it in a great way. And many media, many channels from all over the world, they covered this initiative. And also in Israeli media, where many people in Israel noticed this initiative and they were welcoming it as well. And we started, and me personally, I started to have some contacts over Facebook from the other side. And I was excited to discover the other side also as well. So from there, we started to let the people meet each other through Skype or Zoom. And from there, we started to see what the Gazans needs, what the Gazans wish, you know, from the other side, or maybe just a, you know, a way to communicate and see that we have no difference. You know, we are all human beings. We have some wishes in life we would like to achieve. And maybe it's peace. Maybe it's living together. Maybe it's being to work together on something. Maybe it's a music. Maybe it's a language. Maybe it's, you know, mm-hmm. a session of cooking, you know. So this is what we were trying to do, in order to see if that will work. And that worked actually for a few years. And we continue it actually. And I felt here that we are doing right. And we are trying to see what is the next step could happen. And yeah, that's it. Well, I don't know if you want me to get now into what's happened.
Actually, you know, Manar, before that, I would like to ask you, you know, but growing up in Syria, living in Cairo for some time, and then in Gaza, you know, all of these places, they are known, you know, that people there are not particularly fond of Israelis and even Jews. I mean, you know, there is a lot of bias, a lot of also incitement and so on. You know, I've been personally myself, I visited Damascus and I saw Israeli flag that was an American flag that was basically draw on the ground before one of the universities, and students had to step on it. It was during the 2000s, before the civil war. What was your idea of Israelis and Jews before you met any, before you get into these initiatives? And also, I would like to ask you what people around you, specifically in Gaza, felt, you know, about Israel and the Israelis.
Well, let me say that. Me in particular, or me personally, I grew up with a Palestinian case. Even as a family, we are a conservative family. We support Palestine and we think that Israel is an enemy as a family. And also the television is just 24 hours on the news. And I grew up with these emotions. I grew up with these problems. And even in my school in Syria, we were trying to send donations to Gaza and to be supportive for Gaza and for other parts of Palestine. But for me, I don't think, or I do remember that I had the image and just believed it. And I always sense that I know nothing about the area, even though I'm Palestinian originally. But I always sense that I'm in lack of many informations, and in order to help, I need to gain information and history, of course, about the place, and especially also to talk with the people directly or to be there in that area in order to be able to help. I didn't feel it's logical to just see what's my family reaction or the television reactions and just act, you know, according to it. So when I went to Gaza, I felt this is the maybe the chance, or maybe this is the opportunity to be able to do something for the country I'm in, or the country I belong to, even on papers, let me say. So when I went there, it was the right thing to do, which is to be among the people and to know what's happening for them and what their history is and what do they think also. You know, I can't just have the idea of, you know, I mean, to have a feelings also towards like to hate Israel, or maybe to think that they are my enemy, and you know, and maybe the people have another opinion. So I didn't think it's fair to have anything in mind or to fight for anything before I know more about what's happening and I know more from the people directly. So this is what happened with me, and this is what I did, you know. And until now, I feel all the people, even the Palestinians outside, or maybe the Palestinians also in the West Bank, I think they are really far from the truth of what's happening in Gaza. And I encourage everyone, you know, to just look for more details, for more people from Gaza to speak with, just to know more about what's happening and what do they think, you know.
So what do they think on the Israeli side? Like, what did they talk to you about as well?
Yeah, well, Ibrahim, you know, I talked about it in the beginning. They remember when they were under control of Israel, they remember that they were able to work, they were able to gain money, they were able to do lots of things in their lives, and even to be able to travel, or maybe to gain documents, or maybe to gain another citizenship, or maybe... they feel that it was a golden period for them. They feel it wasn't bad as their period from Hamas right now. And they only remember it as a good period. And they claim, you know, to they wish actually to have it back. But of course, you know, in order also they wish to have it back, but to give them also more rights, you know, not to... let me say, control them in a very bad way, but to control them in a way that they can still have the living they are wishing to have. So,
and you said that, you know, through your youth movement work, mm-hmm. it was actually essentially what that led to your arrest. So can you share with us what happened there, or how, like, what happened there?
Well, we were actually trying to do activities and to let all Sahamas know about what we are trying to do and if there will be any problems between the youth in Gaza, because the Gazans also, let me say that they try to go to the streets demanding from Hamas to give them a better life, and the demonstrations called "We need to leave," and Hamas unfortunately didn't act in a good way. They were like trying also to control them by force again, and by arresting them, by beating them. So we were also trying at that time to manage to speak with Hamas directly and to just point out that the people need more freedom or more rights in this place, and they would appreciate it, you know. So the whole period we were trying to be side to side with them, just in order to make them understand us as young people. I don't want to say we failed. Of course, we succeeded in many things, and they were following us. And I think what it leads us to go to the jail is just they didn't want us to continue, let me say. They were trying to understand. I don't know if they were trying to understand us. They noticed us. They know us. But they even picked a time where we didn't, you know, do it in, let me say, in a public way. The only initiative we were arrested for is just, it was during Corona. It was 2020. And we wanted to the people from outside to join us, to see us, how we are now similar to what the people outside live, where they can't travel, they can't go out of the home, and they can't, you know, practice their daily life. And we sense that they are similar to our situation in Gaza, and we decided just to speak about it. So we had a public invitation over Facebook to let just the people come in and listen to each other. And we were surprised that 250 people from outside, among Israelis, they joined to listen to us, and they joined to have a conversation with us. And actually, I also personally was surprised that after a few days, they started to arrest us one by one. We were 10. And it was quite funny, because they took it as we are cooperating with Israel, and this is normalization, and we should be arrested for that. And I think it's the case itself, it's for more than 10 years, I think, we should be jailed for. And even though during the process of getting jailed, we weren't sure about how they would start the process and what is the end for it, if we will have a lawyer or not. So it's not where you can feel they are following a law, they are following a system. They just can jail you, they can put you in the jail. No one can know about you. And you yourself, you will not know about the case itself. So this is something, me personally, I struggled with. And until I spent, let me say, three months in the jail. And when I started to feel that they are not able to let me, you know, have a, let me, normal conversation with, I stopped eating and drinking. And
you know, so I used to work at the reporter a while ago, and I used to go to Gaza as well until 2007. I can tell you, mm-hmm. frankly, to be jailed by Hamas, it seems like a nightmare scenario. That, yeah. You know, it's a complete nightmare for anybody. And, you know, right now when we have hostages, that are imprisoned by the Hamas, of course, everybody wonders, you know, what's happening inside, how are they being treated? We already have some information from the hostages who are released. Can you share some information? How was it for you, Manar? I'm shivering just asking this question.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Well, it was quite hard, to be honest, where the first 2 weeks I was in a small cell without light, without window even. And it was quite dark. If you would ask, you know, for taking a shower or maybe just to change your clothes or anything, there's no one can hear you, or there is no one to speak with. So they can only deliver the food to you. And it's not literally food. It's, I don't know, something that you just need to eat. So I didn't eat anyway the whole period of these 2 weeks. And then they transferred me to another room where there were another women with me. Of course, I felt like I'm scared because I don't know these people. I don't know what's happening to them. They didn't seem normal to me. More time with them, I started to find the stories and feel that they are victims and they are not people who went mistaken in this place, which is Gaza, you know. So most of them are, let me say, they caught them, I don't know, being with a man, having sex with a man, or being a girlfriend, or so for reasons that they are, I didn't think or I didn't see that they are really dangerous for the community. And they were only taken for reasons that they didn't want to listen to, or they didn't want to believe the people even for what's their crime, you know. So I felt there's no justice in this place. So I felt more comfortable to listen to their stories and see if I can help. Well, I can't help, but maybe I did some efforts when I went out, but I don't think this effort went in the wrong, in the right place, you know. So I think it's a very dark place to be jailed. And I heard also stories where there were people, or there was a woman and her husband were trying to sell some paintings to the Israeli side as an art. And they were both of them arrested, and they were having like 6 children and one baby. It's her age, like 2 months, and they don't care about what is your status. They only care about filling the jails with people and you know, trying to be a country, trying to feel that they are having power over people, and they don't care what is the reasons, if it does make sense or not, you know. So this is what I felt, to be honest.
So how were you released at the end? Can you share a little bit about what happened then?
Well, I got mad eventually, you know, seeing all these cases and seeing myself sitting here without any promise for the case or understanding what's happening with my case. So at that time, I wrote a letter to the military court and for the security place, where I said that from this moment until you hire me a lawyer or I can speak to a lawyer, I'm stop eating and drinking. And I also was honest with myself. I stopped almost for a week, and my body started to get tired at that time. And they started to notice it, where they were, you know, I think in our case, many people from the UN and the Red Cross, they were coming to the jail every week to check on us. So I think they were feeling that we are seen, and many people asking them for us. And so they didn't want to neglect the case, you know. They didn't want to neglect my case especially. So I think after that time, they started to say, okay, we are working on it. We will bring you a lawyer, and we will see how we can release you on a bail. So I paid, and the lawyer came. And then they had the agreement where, Manar, after this, you need to be deported to Cairo. So I do want actually to leave Gaza, but this was a decision from them. And then they actually, yes, after releasing me, they deported me to Cairo, and that's it.
You know, after everything that you've gone through in Gaza, after your experience, and especially now that we're seeing what happened on October 7th and what happened after October 7th, do you still believe there is a still hope for a prospect of peace?
Well, I'm still speaking, let me say, with the people in Gaza, and still following what's happening with them, and still asking them what do they wish for that. And I think their wishes are, first of all, you know, they want to get rid of Hamas, because they think even after the war, they will be very harsh on them, and they will not care about their homes or any of their cases, and they wanted to get rid of them and to replace the authority. So this is their wishes, and I think this is my wish too. It's hard for them, well, of course, to experience what's happening now, but they think about it as the end, you know. They think about it as it's something we will get rid of, which is Hamas, of course. And yeah, that's it.
Manar, can you please tell us a little bit about your involvement in ROPES? Because we are very happy that you are part of our network. How did you first hear about the organization? And, you know, how after, you know, this painful experience in Gaza, you took the decision still to be involved, you know, in some, you know, framework that brings together, you know, forward-thinking Middle Eastern leaders from different places?
Well, I think I came across Robes by Ben, and I met him.
President of Robes.
Exactly, 2 years ago. And he told me about the organization, and I appreciated the efforts he and you guys are putting into this organization. And I think it's important, as long as, and I, of course, joined you last June. To Georgia, and I saw your activities, and I think you are doing great where you tell every country that we are trying to solve the issue, even if it's not now, it might take 10 years, but we are trying to put more efforts to be together on this land, respecting each other and understanding each other's needs. And that is what we need for now, as long as we are, we cannot actually change many facts, but we are working and we need, and that's what the Gazans need as well.
And Manara, I also wanted to ask you about the reactions for 10-7, the massacres of the October the 7th, knowing Gaza as you do. Were you surprised? Were you shocked? Because I think that many people in Israel, even those who've been to Gaza and they know Gazans and so on, still were absolutely shocked by this unbelievable cruelty and sadism, even, you know, of the atrocities that were performed.
Well, let me say, I was shocked, but not surprised, because I know Hamas very well, and I know that they sometimes do things according to what others want from them, but not what they want, actually, like Iran, let me say. And they said it also during what's happening now. Iran said, well, we didn't know about the attack. Hamas said, well, in order to get support from Iran, we need to do things that we never done before, and this is the price we get for us to be, you know, supported by them, and that is can tell us a lot about what happened. I'm not really surprised of them, because I saw how bad they can be on the ground, and I know how bad they can be for their own people before Israel, and it's scary, of course, and we need to take actions and immediate actions towards what happened.
Hamas is still very popular, and we see the polls, you know, for example, now in West Bank, Hamas is much more popular than Fatah or any other organization. And also,
well, that's a problem. That's a problem where the West Bankers, and I said that earlier, they don't know what's happening on the ground of Gaza. They don't know the history of Hamas and how bad they can be and what happened where they exchanged the hostages. It's only about, you know, cleaning their photo, but not caring about them in the first place. And we saw that, and the Gazans also know that. And the Gazans were actually mad and sad to see how the people in the West Bank celebrating the moments, but the people in Gaza are dying because of this. So this is what's the expression. And of course, that is so sad to see. It's not something you can be happy with, you know? So.
And so this is the perception in the West Bank, as you say. So I'm curious, as someone who lives now in the UAE, what were the perceptions there? Do you notice any difference in how Emiratis talk today about the relations with Israel after October 7th? Was there anything that surprised you from comments on October 7th?
No, I didn't see that here, of course. People who are away from what's happening or away from Israel or Gaza who have never been there, of course, they would have the stereotype from the television, and good luck with it. If I will be able to share with them what I saw and they would be convinced, well, good luck. But sometimes it's hard. And I really believe the media is our big problem in our conflict. And I wish one day we will be able to clear it. The people from the Emirates, I think they still have the same idea, and they are really aware of what's happening. And they are still on their opinion. I don't think I saw people changing towards what's happened, you know. And I can still understand people, of course, on their opinion. But of course, they need to know more, and of course, they need to listen more to others' perspective, let me say.
And so I guess before we depart, Manar, I would want to ask you, is there any message that you would like to convey to the Israeli people and the Palestinian people? Give us some hope.
About the future.
Well, about the future, I think we need more efforts, and we need the people to know more about what's going on for the people on both sides, so we can be all helpful to the situation. And if you are wishing, you know, to change something, just dig more for more information, to know more people, and be helpful somehow, and to do not follow the stereotypes and fight, have the something in your head and just fight for it with no reason, with no one with you, with no goal, I mean, with no vision, you know, and that is so bad to see. So I wish all people can have a plan for even being helpful or being supportive for, I don't know, for Israel side, for Palestinian side. You know, you need to know more, you need to understand more, and you need to speak with the people directly. And then I think you will be able to help. And this is what we need, you know, just to help us also, because I think, yeah, that will need time. And we need more people with us, even the Palestinians outside or the Israelis outside, you know, we need them to understand more and to be more helpful than just writing on social media and blaming each other. And I think the situation is totally not black and white. And I wish it was a black and white. It would be easier to solve. But it's not. It's more complicated than that. And I think I wish people will be able to see it in this way, how complicated it is, you know.
Thank you very much, dear Manara. You know, voice is very unique. You have an unbelievable story. I mean, it really deserves, I think, you know, a Hollywood production. And we are very hopeful that there will be more people who inside the darkness will still find hope and will change their perspectives and will understand that the only way towards, you know, forward, it's peace, it's coexistence, it's communication with another, and peaceful solutions for long-term conflicts that still torture us today after so many decades.
Yeah, that's right. You're absolutely right. And thank you for your efforts too, you know, to also take our voices and take them all over the world. And this is awesome. Keep doing it. And thank you for having me.
Thank Shukran you. Jazilan. Thank Shukran. You.
We'll start our petition for Manar for Nobel Peace Prize. No worries.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
We're proud of you. Dear. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay. See you guys soon.
You've been listening to The Ropes Cast, the independent voice of the Middle East. Our guest today was Manar Asharif.
We hope you enjoyed The Ropes Cast. Our podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, and all quality podcast platforms. We are very grateful to all our listeners from the Middle East, Europe, the US, and other parts of the world. You can support our work by small donation. More details on our websites, ropes.org. We also invite you to follow ropes.org on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Thread to learn more about our work with the emerging leaders of the Middle East. I'm Ibrahim Abu Ahmad.
And I'm Ksenia Svitlova.
Shalom.
And salam.